Labor and Commerce Committee, and note for the record that today is Thursday, April 3rd, 2008. Members present are Senators Davis, Ellis, and Stevens. We have a number of items to come before us today. Under bills previously heard, we'll take Senate Bill 113, Nursing Mothers in the Workplace, House Bill 295, Recorded or Filed Documents, and House Bill 379, CPA Education Requirements. We'll take that bill first, Recorded or Filed Documents second, and my bill, Nursing Mothers in the Workplace, third. Then we'll move on to bills for their initial presentation. First will be Senate Bill 280 by Senator Davis, Medicaid Insurance for Cancer Clinical Trials, followed by House Bill 331 by Representative Roses, Motor Vehicles, Licenses, and Impoundments. So that's the game plan for today. Let's begin with Representative Hawker to the top of the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hawker, good afternoon. Welcome back to the committee.
A pleasure to be here, sir.
We've had the initial presentation on the legislation. I don't know that any issues have come up in the interval between the last hearing and this one. So if nothing has come to our attention through staff or the sponsor, we'll entertain committee conversation at this time or a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Senator Chairman, Stevens. I move that we move House Bill 379 out of committee with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
And
again, I want to apologize for calling the sponsor a troglodyte at our last meeting.
Yes, it's
did not mean that.
Important that you meant it in the nicest way possible. And
Mr.
I would,
Chairman, no offense taken. It was in definite conversation. This bill is remedying a mistake we made in previous legislation. Thank you, sir.
I'm most impressed with your co-sponsors of Representatives Dugan, Guerra, Holmes, and Curtula. That's
Mr.
That's
Chairman,
quite a statement.
That was strategic. We thought it might help us with this committee.
Absolutely.
Oh.
And it did. Co-sponsorship will get you everywhere. So, any further discussion of the motion to move the bill? Is there any objection to the motion to move the bill? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Hawker, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Members of the committee.
You're welcome. Okay, let's move on to House Bill 295 by Representative Lynn. Ms. Manley, good afternoon. Welcome back. Can you just remind us the subject at hand and if any concerns or questions have come up in the meantime?
Yes, my name is Nancy Manley, and I'm staff to Representative Bob Lynn. And this is a bill, is a cleanup bill for the recorder's office. We were asked to carry it for them. So it's a lot of technicalities of the things that they that would make things run smoother and bring them more up to date with our technology that we have.
And we had good thank you, Ms. Manley. We had good testimony from Vicki Backus from the recorder's office at the last meeting, and no concerns or issues have arisen.
No opposition for
no
this.
No opposition to the bill. Yeah. Okay. Is there any discussion of the bill? Is there a motion? Senator Stevens.
Sure, I move that we move Senate Bill, or House Bill 295 out with an attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay. Thank you for the motion. Is there any discussion?
Oops.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The bill moves on. Representative Lynn, thank you very much. Okay, give us just a second here to catch up on some of the paperwork. Okay, we're going to, where's Patrick? Patrick, come on up. This is Patrick Cunningham, my legislative intern, courtesy of the University of Alaska Anchorage. Professor, good afternoon. Senate Bill 113 is now before us, Nursing Mothers in the Workplace, and we do have a proposed committee substitute. And I'd like to ask Mr. Cunningham to just identify himself for the record and walk us through the proposed CS.
Thank you. Patrick Cunningham, intern to Senator Ellis. There's a new committee substitute. The intent of the committee substitute was to provide more flexibility to the employer in terms of implementing the bill. Two changes were made. One change was made on line 10, section B. It had previously included the word secure. That was removed, and the bill now states that an employer shall provide a private and sanitary room or other location in close proximity to the work area. The other change that was made is a new section on line 13, section C, which states, nothing in this section requires an employer to allow a child in the workplace at times other than break times. This was in response to Senator Stevens, who questioned whether or not an employer would have to provide daycare and allow the child to remain for the entire day, and that was changed to change the wording, so that assumption was not made. Mm-hmm. And that was the only change that was made to the rest of the bill.
Okay. So that was a valid concern, and we wanted to clarify that and make sure people knew that would not be as large an impact on businesses as some might have presumed.
Yes.
Okay, we're talking about the Wayne backslash E committee substitute, representing the changes Mr. Cunningham just took us through. I'm presenting that as an improvement to the bill. Chair will entertain a motion to adopt that CS.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the CS Senate Bill Number 1113 backslash E.
Okay.
For discussion purposes.
Thank you for the motion. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, so ordered. That is the item before us. I would note that this bill does have a further referral to the HES Committee. And while this bill may not be expected to pass all the way through the legislature this year, I wanted to get it out there for the advocates, the breastfeeding advocates around the state, and begin this discussion and promote this idea. So it may be a longer-term project, but I was hoping today to move it on in case the HES committee has time and interest in considering it this year. So is there any further discussion of the bill? I'll entertain a motion to move the bill.
I haven't heard from business organizations like the Chamber or NFIB. I see Mr. DeWitt out there. Just a response to the requirement to provide a private and sanitary room, the impact that might have, mm-hmm. and I'd appreciate
sure.
some comments from somebody.
Sure. Mr. Cunningham, if you could vacate the chair there.
Sure.
I'm happy to entertain more public testimony. Mr. DeWitt, good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Denny DeWitt with the National Federation of Independent Business. We have provided the committee with a letter of opposition to this legislation. While the issue for us is not the issue of the efficacy of breastfeeding, that's something that certainly is a health issue that we respect. We do have, we think, a very close relationship with our employees who are our friends and neighbors, and we've been able to work out most of our issues with them, and we think that that's the way these sorts of issues ought to be addressed. I would point out that in all the testimony I've heard, testimony tends to be heavily from state employees, for example, from large employers. We have small employers who in a mall, for example, may or may not even have a restroom of their own. So providing a private and sanitary room becomes a real problem. When you put this in the labor code, it allows some labor inspector to come out and make a judgment on what's an undue hardship for the employer. The person making that decision prior to forcing a small employer to act has no fiduciary responsibility for their decision. That falls totally on the employer. We try and work things out as best we can, but we have real concerns about having state inspectors making decisions on what's an economic hardship for an employer when they have no basis for that, and once they make the decision, they have no responsibility for the decision. So the idea of nursing mothers is a good one. We think we can work that out in the workplace. We have real fear of state mandates in this area.
Okay. Further, any other questions? Or?
No, thank you. And then maybe just a question of your staffer again.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. DeWitt. Mr. Cunningham, could you come back to the table? Senator Stevens.
Just a comment that and a question, I guess, because this also includes schools, and as the people who fund schools, does this, what does it mean in a school situation every elementary school, every high school, every building that houses administrators would have to have a similar facility. Is that true?
Mr. Cunningham.
Chair, Senator Stevens, you're saying, for instance, if the employee is the teacher who is nursing a child, that's what you're talking about, whether or not that would be provided for that nursing mother to do that. I would think if the ability was to provide for that, they certainly could do so. I think if they also demonstrated that this would be undue hardship and difficult, then perhaps would not be required to do so. That may be left up to the state agency charged with implementing the program to sort of clarify that for each situation as it arises. But I would think in the long run, these are hopefully minimal, and that by and large, most facilities would be able to work out some type of arrangement for the nursing mother and child, recognizing how important it is, and certainly promoting the well-being of both the mother and the nursing child.
Mr. Cunningham, in your research on the legislation, I know you were new to the bill this year, though I introduced it last year. Did you come across any information about how it's handled in other countries, European countries, for example, with their large employers, smaller employees, employers, accommodations that were made in those circumstances?
Mm-hmm. The chair, I didn't look at it from an international perspective. I certainly looked at it from a state perspective, and all of the Pacific states, with the exception of Alaska, do have this family-friendly legislation in place, and apparently seems to provide well for that. Some studies of corporations have really found it is a benefit to the employer in the long run in terms of less absence. Usually mothers who are nursing their children have healthier children. They don't have to stay at home and be absent from work, and because of the difference, the statistics have demonstrated that it's really a benefit to the employer as well as the employee in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further comments or questions? Again, I would say, you know, this is a conversation starter. I'd like to send the bill on to the HES committee. This is a longer-term project. We'd have to make some accommodations with small businesses and figure out better refine the policy in the future. So it's an issue I hope to continue to work on in the next legislature. But it's not ready for passage or close to having the support to pass into law this year. So I think, even though you're new to the system as an intern, I think you've realized that as well, that there's more work and debate to have. But at this time, I wanted to give other folks an opportunity to hear the issue if they so choose. So, Senator Davis, could I impose on you for a motion to move the bill forward?
Oh, sure. If you need a motion to move it forward, it
yes,
has
please.
To come to my committee anyway, right?
Yes, it does.
Before I make that motion, I think that maybe some of the concerns that you might have about providing these spaces has already been done without being done already without this bill being in place. Mm-hmm. Lots of employers are already allowing employees to have a place to have their babies and do nurse or save milk or whatever they need to do. And in the schools, there shouldn't be much of a problem because they got the nurse's office, they got many other facilities that could be used to utilize that. I see this as a good piece of legislation even for small businesses because they might not have a whole lot of office space, but they might be able to use a cubby, or just a cubicle or whatever, just somewhere where they could be alone. It's not going to cause any real hardship on anyone to provide that. And if they just can't do it, I suppose they don't have to, as long as they know they made a good faith effort to do it. I think the employee would go along with that. And if they were not going along with it, then it might cause a problem because they might report back that my employer wouldn't provide this for me. I made no accommodation for me to leave for a short period of time. This bill is only going to go to the HES. Just from the standpoint of what I see here, I think my committee is not going to have much problem trying to pass this out. It doesn't go to finance. Mm-hmm. And it's a possibility that it might not pass the House side, but we will definitely move it along on the HES committee.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. I just meant that it may not be to the point of having enough support in each body to pass. I mean, 21 votes in the House and 11 votes in the Senate, but that's the goal we're working towards someday.
Well, anyway, I move that CS Senate Bill number 133 /E be moved from this committee with individual recommendation.
Okay. Senate Bill 1.
There's no fiscal note here? None.
Yeah. Senate Bill 113. Okay, we have a okay. Thank you, Senator Davis. We have a motion before us. Any discussion? Any objection to sending the bill along? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Cunningham. Okay, let's move on to Senate Bill 280, Medicaid Insurance for Cancer Clinical Trials, by Senator Davis. And Mr. Obermeyer is with us. Good afternoon. If you'd like to go ahead with your initial presentation of the bill, and then we have one bill following.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The bill before you is a committee substitute for Senate Bill 280 HESS, requiring health care insurers to provide insurance coverage for medical care received by a patient during certain approved clinical trials designed to test and improve prevention, diagnosis, treatment, or palliation of cancer, directing the Department of Health and Social Services to provide Medicaid services to persons who participate in clinical trials relating to experimental procedures and providing for an effective date. Clinical trials are research studies that test how well new medical approaches work in patients. Each study answers scientific questions and tries to find better ways to prevent, screen for, diagnose, or treat disease. Patients who take part in cancer clinical trials have an opportunity to contribute to the knowledge of and progress against cancer. They also receive state-of-the-art treatment from experts in the field. The National Cancer Institute is part of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, reports 6,000 cancer trials in the United States at any one time, including prevention, diagnosis, treatment, quality of life, and genetic studies. SB 280, this committee substitute, removes important barriers to the participation of patients in clinical trials in Alaska, requires all health care plans, including Medicaid, cover routine patient care costs for patients enrolled in all phases of clinical trials, including prevention, detection, treatment, palliation of cancer. Currently, Alaska health care plans can exclude coverage for routine patient care costs while a patient with cancer is enrolled in a clinical trial. Providers of health care plans often conclude that money is saved by excluding care while patients participate in trials, but these patients, if not enrolled in clinical trials, will continue to receive conventional therapy roughly at the same or slightly increased cost in the short and the long run. Studies have shown that very few, only 2 or 3% of eligible adult patients enroll in these trials, as indicated by the NCSL, National Conference of State Legislatures, without in-state facilities and support of clinical trials, participants in Alaska currently have to travel out of state, increasing the cost of non-emergency transportation, which is about 3% of total Medicaid costs. In 2007, an estimated 4,600 patients received cancer treatments throughout Alaska's Medicaid program at a cost of $21.5 million. The average payment per beneficiary was $2,675. About half of this was paid by the federal government. Based on an estimated 2.5% participation per above, about 115 patients are expected in Alaska to participate in clinical trials each year. If you had a 6.5% estimated increase for 115 persons, it'd add $35 per year to a Medicaid cancer patient. Non-emergency transportation costs would be another $15 a year. The fiscal note adds an estimated $50,000, with federal government paying half of this. 23 states, I think it's significant, have passed legislation for special agreements requiring health plans to pay the cost of routine medical care patient costs while participating in clinical trials. There is a handout that is a grid that you have that indicates at least 20 of the states that are participating at this time, and many of them in all phases of the trials. I might also note that this committee substitute from the HESS committee made a number of changes as requested by the Division of Insurance that also comports with the American Society of Clinical Oncology in a handout, which you also have in your package, that indicates that those that those costs be routine costs, they be for therapeutic intent. It has to be approved by one of the major agencies like the NIH. The trial is conducted according to a written protocol for scientific purposes and justification. It's undergone scientific review. The trials have approved are approved by qualified institutional review, and the most importantly, no non-investigational therapy that is clearly superior to the protocol of the treatment, and available clinical or preclinical data is provide a reasonable expectation that protocol treatment will be at least as efficacious as non-investigational therapy. So basically what this bill has done is it's trying to draw more people into the trials, because we still have a great incidence of cancer in Alaska. It's felt that those patients who do participate are always at risk of not being covered for routine care, and that this will encourage them to participate at a greater rate in order to save lives and find answers to cancer.
Okay. Mr. Obermeyer, thank you for your presentation. Are there any questions at this stage? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to understand what clinical trials are. Can you give me a definition of that? Is that entirely a voluntary thing?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, clinical trials are always voluntary. In fact, a patient that volunteers can pull out at any time as well. The trials are offered, and for the most part are almost entirely covered in expenses by the federal government, and also through drug companies and private organizations such as that American Association of Oncology that encouraged trying to find scientific answers to these questions. And the only way to try to improve the present state of the art in cancer treatment present trials that can be documented, and then the results are usually in current and modern medicine transmitted in journals instantaneously all over the country, in fact all over the world. So almost all of these developments are followed immediately. It's one of the reasons that in the Genome Project you saw so many advances so quickly, not only because of the computers, but because everyone's exchanging knowledge.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, no. Mm-hmm. I would also say that I think we have some doctors on, and they might be able to speak to that further if you would like.
Okay. Senator Stevens?
Well, I guess my other question is, who pays for this? I think I know who pays for it. I think I pay for it when I pay for my insurance. Why isn't it all of this covered by either the drug companies or the federal studies? Why are you asking insurance companies to pick up the cost?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, when I say there are so many costs that aren't covered, all this bill asks for is a routine patient care visit cost to the insurance company, and not to exclude those patients who normally would hesitate to participate, because if you notice, one of the doctors that had written in to you had indicated some of these patients are afraid they will be dropped, and in fact may be dropped from routine coverage if they participate in a trial. Some of these trials are out of state. And the important thing here is, I mean, those costs to have all the hospitals and the doctors and all the equipment in these trials across the country, bringing people in from around the country, are extremely expensive. Our state doesn't pay for that. What they're asking for is the coverage for the routine care that these people would receive normally if they didn't participate in trials. But what happens currently is that if they want to participate in trials, they're afraid they're going to be dropped, and they will not get the routine care they would if they didn't participate at all. And this covers that. And in fact, we made a change in the bill to make sure that these were only routine costs, that there could not be extraordinary costs of coverage that might include some of those some of the other factors you just brought in.
Okay. At this stage, I'd like to get on with some of the public testimony, and we'll probably come back to some of those issues. So, Mr. Obermeyer, if you could just shift over there. I'd note for the record that we have Dennis Bailey from Ledge Legal available for questions, Emily Neenan from the Cancer Society, and a Dr. Subramanian for questions. But let's go now to Linda Hall. Ms. Hall, if you could join us at the table. Give us your impression of the legislation. And Linda will be followed by Mr. DeWitt, and then we'll go to teleconference for Krista Rangich. So, Ms. Hall, good afternoon. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Linda Hall, Division of Insurance. I would like to echo Mr. Obermeyer's comments. The sponsor did work with my office and my staff on language. Concerns that we had about the bill as it was written that would have been made it difficult for us to enforce should this become legislation. So there are a number of changes here, and we very much appreciate those changes. We did research on a number of other states that have similar requirements in their statutes, and we tried to bring the bill in line with those other states. I really only want to add the thing I add for every insurance mandate, and I'll try to make that very brief. As I did last week when we talked about mandates, I included that in my fiscal note. I am concerned about the fact that this bill only applies to a very small percentage of Alaskans. And I think the whether you want the coverage to apply or not is certainly a legislative policy call. But as I look at mandates, and we've had a significant number of those bills proposed in the last 2 years, we only have those that apply to the insurance industry, the insurance marketplace that is regulated by the Division of Insurance, and that's about 40% of the insurance marketplace. We have a large number of self-insureds. About 60% of the insurance today is done through various types of self-insured plans which are regulated by the feds under ERISA. And we have a series of non-governmental plans. I will use, for example, the state of Alaska. This particular piece of legislation would not apply to state of Alaska employees through the Select Benefits Plan. It may or may not apply to some of the union health trusts, for example. We have not to date enforced the Title 21 with the union health trust for a number of reasons. We think it's likely that it could apply to some of them, but will result only after protracted litigation, which we've chosen not to use our resources to do at this point. So when we consider the validity, the necessity, the real good that may be caused by some of the mandates, I think we need to keep in mind who it applies to and does it create an unlevel playing field, and that is a concern. Depending upon the number of mandates that we have in our statutory scheme, we may have a potential to increase cost. I can't give you, it's very difficult to pin down each mandate's cost in itself, but I do have, and I've spoken in front of this committee about the increased cost of health care. But I would agree with the sponsor staff who spoke. We are really in the bill only looking at routine health care that would be provided otherwise. Some health insurance contracts will exclude anything to do with someone who is involved in an experimental type of process. This puts some good controls, I think, on that. So I don't think we see in this an attempt to have insurance companies paying for the clinical trials. Those are borne by drug companies, American Cancer Society, various sponsoring entities, including grants from the federal government. And there are various phases that they go through. So I think the bill as it's written today has limited some of those things that we felt were maybe overreaching.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hall. Questions? Senator Stevens.
Linda, I am sorry, I am totally ignorant of this, but could this be like a test on say the flu? And what in the test, could you be given the flu and see how you respond? And I mean, is this that type of a test, or what kind of tests are we talking about here?
Through the chair, I'm certainly not an expert. I'm not a doctor, but I will tell you from the reading that I've done, which is somewhat limited. It's my understanding that no, it's not something you would be given. It's you have been diagnosed with some form of cancer, and various medications that have already been developed and have been approved through a series of tests before they're ever allowed to be used, I guess I would say, on human beings. They've gone through that kind of process to determine if they have a benefit for you as a cancer patient. And they would first have their different levels of that testing process. So there's a test to see if it's helpful, and then tests with control groups where I assume they use a placebo and a real drug and various things like that. But we're also looking here at things that really have shown to have some reasonable expectation of a beneficial effect. So I don't think it's experimental to the sense that you're questioning, Senator.
Mm-hmm. If you don't mind, sure. Greg, just a little
further on. No, go ahead. Go right ahead.
Say, for example, you know, they give me the placebo, they give you the real thing. Would there ever be an instance where I would then have more of a demand on my insurance company because my disease only got progressively worse, whereas yours improved because you had the right thing and mine got worse? And what you're saying is that I can't remember the term that was used, but it's not extraordinary.
No, routine care.
Routine yeah. care. Would there be anything beyond routine care? But for example, if my disease only got worse and worse, would my insurance be forced to pay additional costs eventually or not?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I guess I would say, and I'm trying to think of a tactful way, but we all know I'm pretty blunt. I think what you're describing is if you were given the placebo, you probably are going to get progressively worse you would have anyway without some kind of treatment, I think is what I'm hearing you say. Where if you haven't been given the drug that's being tested in this clinical trial, I mean, you wouldn't have been had you not participated. And I think you have a full awareness of those risks, so to speak, or lack of benefit, that I don't think you're given notice that you are or are not given the drug, because that would be kind of counterproductive. But I don't envision the insurance company having additional charges or expenses that they might not have anyway. It's not to say that they might not have some things that are maybe a little more expensive because you may have more tests than you might have normally, but I really don't think the intent of routine care, and it's why we specifically ask for medical care to be changed to routine care and defined it pretty carefully, so that didn't occur.
Okay. Ms. Hall, if folks don't mind, I'm going to switch up the order. Mr. DeWitt, I'm not going to take you next. We'll get back to you if that's okay. I want to go down the list to Dr. Mary Stewart from Denali Oncology, who may be able to answer some of the questions that have come up, and then we'll get back to the other folks. Dr. Stewart, are you there?
I am.
Please identify yourself and any affiliation for the record, and go ahead, please.
My name is Dr. Mary Stewart. I'm an oncologist in Anchorage, and I'm the current president of the Denali Oncology Group, which is an organization including the medical and radiation oncologists in our state. Basically, we're the cancer doctors. We got together last year into a formal organization and talked about what our biggest priority should be to improve cancer care in our state, and it was this. It was improving access to and enrolling more patients in clinical trials. This is why I'm here. As far as talking about what the clinical trials consist of, there are all different kinds, but a typical one in cancer medicine would be to take a certain treatment A, we'll call it, which may be the regular standard treatment for whatever, we'll say, lung cancer. And then you have a treatment B, which usually there's a good deal of preliminary evidence is thought to be probably close, might even be better than treatment A. And so patients who say, okay, I'll enroll in this clinical trial, I'll get treatment A or B, and then we find out which one is better. Generally, in cancer medicines, we do not use placebo controls. It's considered unethical because cancer is a deadly disease. So pretty much everyone gets the standard of care treatment. But this is how we learn. The diagnosis and treatment of cancer has gotten better over time and could be better still. For the 2,650 Alaskans who will be diagnosed with cancer in our state, having good treatment options is essential. Clinical trials are just programs to see which treatments work and which do not. Knowing what doesn't work is just as important as knowing what does. At the last meeting of the HESS committee on 326, I was listening in on the by teleconference when one of the members, I believe it was Senator Dyson, asked about costs, and I didn't know how to signal that I would like to add a few comments. But the fact is that cancer is a costly disease no matter what way you cut it. The costs of imaging, CAT scans, MRIs, because we need to know if we're doing a treatment, is it working or isn't it? Most of the time, you can't tell except by doing additional x-rays. So there's that. There are many blood tests. Many of our medicines are expensive. But many of them now are better than what we used to have. But knowing what doesn't work is also important. Back in the 90s, there was preliminary evidence that survival in breast cancer was prolonged by high-dose chemotherapy with bone marrow transplant. The data was looking very promising. Some randomized clinical trials were started. Dr. Vernita Spencer, my colleague, even opened a program for high-dose chemotherapy for breast cancer patients in our state so they wouldn't have to travel out of state. But when all was said and done, when the randomized, controlled clinical trials were finally completed and reported, high-dose chemotherapy did not add anything. This, at the time, was a $100,000 procedure. It's more now. But money was saved by having accurate information. Knowledge is power, and it promotes better care. Patients who agree to be enrolled in these trials are very special people. It is with their help that we learn, and with their help that we cure more people. Yesterday, I saw a math teacher in her mid-40s who was successfully treated with Hodgkin's lymphoma with chemotherapy and radiation 5 years ago. It was a pleasure to tell her that she's cured and does not need an oncology follow-up anymore. I would like to be able to do that a lot more often. Many of you may have been touched by cancer in families and friends. You understand that better treatments are what we need to deal with this deadly disease. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this issue with you, and I ask you to support Senate Bill 280.
Dr. Stewart, thank you very much. Can we go now to Dr. Anderson? Or Senator Stevens for Dr. Stewart?
Dr. Stewart, I think I understand what you're saying. Can you tell me what the routine care is you're talking about for someone who's in a clinical trial? What is the routine care that we're speaking of here? What could it be?
Well, it would be a lot of what I was talking about. Blood tests, monitoring tumor marker levels, x-rays, including CAT scans and MRIs. These are things that have to be done anyway. To think that someone who doesn't enroll on a clinical trial isn't going to get care is inaccurate. These folks will get chemotherapy or radiation or whatever is appropriate to their situation. So there's not going to be no cost to the insurance company. The costs are actually pretty comparable. Clinical trials really don't add much at all to the cost of care of cancer. Cancer care is expensive to begin with.
Well, thank you, Doctor. And just to sort of put a cross that T, are you saying that there are no additional costs for routine care for someone in a clinical trial? There are no more additional costs than there would be for a person who was not in that clinical trial?
I would not go so far as to say there are no increased costs. There probably would be some, maybe an extra x-ray or an extra blood test. But I have a report from a group called the Council on Affordable Health Insurance, which is an industry group, I believe, and that group estimated the cost of covering clinical trials as less than 1%. I can fax this to you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Let's go on to Dr. Anderson.
Hello?
Hello. Please give your name and affiliation and go ahead quickly.
Yeah, this is Dr. Jeannie Anderson. I've sent this in electronically, but I can read it if you'd like me to.
Well, if you could summarize, we will include it in written form in the public record, but go ahead and read it if it's short. If it's very long, if you could summarize, that would be great.
Okay, it's short. I'm a physician in private practice in Alaska, and I thank you for considering this bill. As mentioned before, it's predicted that 2,650 Alaskans will be diagnosed with cancer this calendar year. In the 1970s, only 50% of cancer patients live 5 years after diagnosis. In 2008, 66% are predicted to survive 5 years. We all know that many Alaskans die of cancer every day, that improvements are desperately needed. The cancer physicians in Alaska are committed to providing the best care possible to our patients to relieve suffering and reduce death from cancer. In caring for our patients, we often turn to clinical trials as providing the best treatment for our patients. A clinical trial is a formal scientific way to test whether a new treatment is safe, effective, and superior to existing treatments. The physicians in hospitals in Alaska support the clinical trials, and there are over 50 trials open currently in our state for cancer patients. However, only a small number of patients enroll in these trials, approximately 40 patients per year. There are many reasons for this low enrollment. These reasons include lack of knowledge or interest on the part of the patient or the physician, lack of availability of an appropriate trial, or, as is relevant to this bill, lack of insurance coverage, or fear by the patient that they will lose coverage if enrolled in the study. If we pass this bill, we'll clearly remove an important barrier to the access of a clinical trial. It will result in improved care for our patients, reduce the burden of cancer in our population, and facilitate patients to stay in Alaska for state-of-the-art care. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. We appreciate your time today and giving testimony. Any questions for the presenter? If not at this time, let's go ahead with Mr. Denny DeWitt here at the Juno site, and then we're going to go back on teleconference for Krista Rangich and then Emily Neenan as well. So, Mr. DeWitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Denny DeWitt, Alaska Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. We appreciate where the intent of this bill. However, we must oppose it. There are several reasons that we do oppose it. Many you've already heard, and let me underscore those. To begin with, the employees that are your responsibility, the state employees, are not covered by this bill. And it seems ironic to us that you would mandate this kind of coverage on small businesses in Alaska and not mandate it on employees of the state. ERISA plans are exempted. Union welfare benefit plans are not covered. As Ms. Hall indicated, about 60% of the coverage is not included in this bill. So those expenses that do incur as a result of this fall heavily on small businesses in Alaska. We know that the uninsured are growing, and we also know that small employers are more hesitant now to offer employee-based health insurance than they have been historically. Many of those who have been providing health care coverage are finding ways to get out of that because of the cost. This is one more straw applied to the camel's back. And as Ms. Hall indicated, there have been a number of other good-intentioned bills introduced in this session that would increase the cost. Those kinds of things encourage my members to look at the notion of offering health insurance quite cautiously. We don't think that's really where we want to go. The comment was made that this would add less than 1%, and that could be true. But the problem is when we add a number of less than 1%, again, you're pushing the pressure onto small employers. And I would point out that it's not insurance companies that have to pay these costs. These costs flow to the premium payer, and those premium payers are the small employers and their employees that are sharing in the cost of insurance. I think that our point is clearly that it makes us less competitive with particularly those large employers that can afford to be providing ERISA plans and are not covered. And we believe that this is the kind of legislation that encourages particularly small employers not to be in the employer-based market.
Okay. Mr. DeWitt, thank you for your time. Any questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go quickly to Krista Rangich and then Emily Neenan, and then we have another person here in the room. Mr. Rangich, or Ms. Rangich, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Krista Rankage. I'm a cancer research nurse at Providence Alaska Medical Center. I am not representing Providence, but speaking on my own behalf today. From my perspective, when a clinical trial is recommended to a patient by their physician as the best treatment option, they are referred to our office. And part of my discussion about the study with the patient includes informing them that their insurance company may not cover some or all of the costs associated with treating their cancer while on the study. And I strongly encourage all patients to find out what their policy says about clinical trial coverage. And at this stage, where, in my experience, we encounter the majority of the roadblocks to patient enrollment to clinical trials. And we all know that patients go through a lot emotionally and financially when being diagnosed with cancer. The last thing they should have to worry about is finding out if their insurance will cover a clinical trial that their physician thinks is in their best interest. And one of our ever-increasing reasons for patients not going on a clinical trial is because of lack of or fear of lack of insurance coverage. And there are many instances where, due to the severity of the cancer and the necessity to start treatment right away, there just isn't reasonable sufficient amount of time to investigate if the insurance will cover the expenses or the insurance company just takes too long to determine coverage. In closing, I think if insurance companies were mandated to cover routine costs included in the clinical trial, I'm confident that more people would be able to participate in clinical trials, which in turn would increase the likelihood of improving cancer treatments and hopefully someday finding a cure. Thanks again for the opportunity and for considering Senate Bill 280.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your time today. Senator Stevens has a question.
Well, just curious, Chris, I'm not sure who you work for, but if we were to pass this, would your insurance company offer you this coverage?
Yes, Senator. I work for Providence Alaska Medical Center, and I'd have to defer that question. I'm not sure. I can find out for you, though.
Be interested to know that. Thank you.
Some indication they may be under federal ERISA. Okay, Ms. Rangich, thank you very much for your testimony today. Emily Neenan, are you there?
Hi, this is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society. And I just wanted to point out a couple things, points of clarification. Ms. Hall mentioned that the state regulates about 40% of insurance plans in the state. And I just wanted to mention that just because the state only regulates that 40% doesn't mean that the other 60% are not providing this coverage. Medicare made the decision to add this coverage some years ago when we worked on the colorectal cancer screening insurance requirement. We knew that 3/4 of the federal employee plans were already making that coverage. Medicare was covering it. Active state employees were already covering it. And a number of these self-insured plans actually made the decision to follow the state law. So having that precedent in statute was really important, even for the plans that are not regulated by the state. But I just wanted to point out that a number of other plans are covering this, even though the state doesn't regulate that. I also wanted to mention that there's been a little bit of confusion about who was online, and there is a patient who just ran into my office and said she was online and got cut off. So I just wanted to mention that to you as well.
Okay, Ms. Neenan, thank you for your time today. It's good to hear your voice, and we appreciate your good work at the society. And we'll do our best to try and make sure everyone's included who's available online. But here in the room in Juneau, there's Donna Carroll. Ms. Carroll, if you'd like to come forward. We're happy to have you come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you considering considering this bill, and I wanted to say this about that. When I was diagnosed 10 years ago, I was fortunate to be in such critical shape that they shipped me immediately to Seattle, and my oncologist down there said, well, we have this clinical trial you can enroll in. It's a phase 3 trial. Your treatment will not be any different than what I would put you on if you were not in this clinical trial. However, they want to test 2 drugs. They want to test to see whether the drug works better if we give it at the same time as the standard of care or if we give it later than the standard of care. And so I said, sign me up. Fortunately, there was no additional cost of standard ordinary care. It was a phase 3 trial. However, this was a critical scientific question that needed to be answered in order to prolong our lives. Do we give these 2 drugs together over 12 weeks, or do we give them separately, one after the other? And by enrolling in this clinical trial, the people that get this drug now, or these 2 drugs now, and it's still the standard of care, it's considered the gold standard, they give them together because this clinical trial answered that question. It was better to give them together rather than sequentially. And that's many of the types of clinical trials that are critical at this stage of the game in cancer treatment. Which works better, doing it separately, doing it together, doing them 6 months apart? And since I had enrolled in one, I was treated on one, and I thought I would testify today. I appreciate your listening.
Thank you, Ms. Carroll. Are there any questions? If not, thank you for your personal contribution to medical science. Okay, is there anyone else here in the room or online who would like to testify on the bill? This is the initial public hearing. The bill does have a further referral. It's a Senate bill that has a further referral to the Finance Committee. We will hold it. If there's no one else to testify, we will hold it over at this time.
Senator?
Oh, yes, please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, hello. For the record, my name is Beverly Woolley. I'm the director of the Alaska Division of Public Health. However, I'm here today to testify as a private citizen and a cancer survivor. And first, I'd just like to thank the Senate and Labor Commerce Committee for providing the opportunity to testify today. I just have to say that there's few things that can so completely rock your entire life as hearing the words that you've been diagnosed with cancer. Despite extensive family history of cancer, my personal diligence in aggressively monitoring my cancer risk, and my training as a health professional, I wasn't prepared for the emotional turmoil following my diagnosis in 2004. Everything that I had was focused on survival and ensuring that I received the best possible care, the most updated course of therapy possibly. Shortly after my diagnosis, I learned I was eligible for a clinical trial. I spent literally days and days on the internet looking at all of the options and decided this was the best course of action for me and for my cancer. Not only to enhance my chances of survival, but also immediately I thought of my daughter, who was now at much greater risk for this horrible disease, and how I might be able to increase her chance of survival someday. So at a time when there wasn't much hope, it really gave me hope and strength that I might be able to contribute to research as well as doing better for my own self. But then that good feeling was short-lived when I panicked because I found out that my insurance might not cover the cost of the trial that I wanted to participate in. And that was only brought about and probably worsened because at age 17, my father, after 3 years of fighting cancer that he had no insurance for, he died. But during that time of fighting the cancer with no insurance, we had depleted all of our savings as a family, and we were right on the verge of losing our home. To this day, my mother still suffers from the financial loss that occurred those many years ago. And here I was, faced with a very similar problem. Was my family now going to be in jeopardy? Did I have to choose my care over maybe sacrificing what my family would have? Fortunately for me, my story ended up with a happy ending. My insurance did eventually determine that they would cover the cost of the clinical trial, and I think one of the reasons was it was able to be demonstrated that the cost was not going to be a significant difference. And I received the care that I needed. Research was gained, new important information vital to improving future cancer care. What would have happened if that would have gone the other way and the insurance denied my coverage and my clinical trial? I try not to even think about that. We know that with clinical trials, we learn more information, and even though there may be a short-term increase, very small as has been pointed out, the long-term we find better cures that can keep people healthy longer, and you see a decrease in the cost of care. Today, you have the power to take a stand against cancer and to move legislation forward that would actually improve care and reduce barriers for those who want to participate in clinical trials. And with that, I just ask you to please vote yes on Senate Bill 280. Thank you.
Ms. Woolley, thank you very much for your powerful testimony. I appreciate it. We appreciate it very much. Is there anyone else online or here in the room who would like to testify? If not at this time, we're going to hold over Senate Bill 280 for further consideration in the near future. Thank you all very much. Okay, let's move on quickly to House Bill 331, Motor Vehicles Insurance Licenses Impoundments, by Representative Bob Roses. Okay. I guess Representative Roses is busy with important business elsewhere. Ms. Kieneman, good afternoon. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and go ahead with the initial presentation on the bill. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Roses. He does extend his apologies for not being able to attend today. I'll be brief.
That always makes us feel better when the absent House member staffer puts something on the record about that. But it is a busy time of year.
It is.
And we understand. Yeah. So,
House Bill 331 addresses four different things. The first thing that 331 does is drops a penalty for failure to notify the Department of Motor Vehicles of a name or address change from a Class B misdemeanor to a fine of not more than $25. The next thing that the bill does is adds an affirmative defense clause to the Alaska statutes that states if a person's license has been suspended for failure to show proof of insurance, that it's an affirmative defense if they go to court and, you know, show them that they did in fact have insurance at the time. The third thing House Bill 331 does is states if a person does not have vehicle insurance, they are guilty of a Class B misdemeanor and a fine of at least $500. Currently, right now, the only fine for driving without insurance is a license suspension of 90 days to a year. And we believe that, you know, they are costing the state and the other drivers more money by driving without insurance, and that there should be a penalty involved in that. The last thing, current statute says right now that a person must fill out a form following a vehicle accident proving that they did in fact have insurance at the time. If a person fails to fill out that form, a notice is sent to the person requiring them to send in the response. If they don't, after 30 days, the Department of Motor Vehicles suspends the person's driver's license. They send the notice to the address that they have on file, not to the address that is listed on the accident report. So what Section 4 does is changes the notification procedure that the department takes. They say that instead of sending it to the address that DMV has on file, that they can send it to the most current address, whether that's the address on the accident report or the address that DMV has on file. And that, in essence, is House Bill 331.
Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. Are there questions at this stage? We have Whitney Brewster, the Director of Division of Motor Vehicles, online to answer questions. Ms. Brewster, could you come forward? I just want to get your impression of the legislation and the logistics involved with implementation. There are zero fiscal notes here. Would you like to speak to any of that, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. The division supports the legislation before the committee today. It allows us the ability to send notice to the most current address, which increases the likelihood that the recipient will indeed receive the notice. So, like I said, we support this legislation. It can be implemented fairly easily at the division, and thus there is a zero fiscal note before you.
Okay, so can just so we can put it on the record, Ms. Brewster, what is the current practice then of the division, and then this change doesn't really require much or any staff power then to implement?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. What we do is we send an initial notice to the individual requesting that they provide notice or, I'm sorry, proof of insurance. If they do not do that, we send them a second notice via certified mail that indicates that they have 30 days to let us know that they do have insurance at that time. After that time, we do suspend their license. This legislation allows us, because right now we currently send the notice to the address that we have on their record. This allows us an additional option to send it to the address that we may know, the address on the report of the accident, so that if that is a more current address, we can send it to that address.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any other questions for Ms. Brewster? If not, thank you for being with us today. Anything you'd like to say and wrap up, Ms. Kinnaman? No?
No.
Okay.
Unless the committee has any questions.
Okay. Yeah, if there are any concerns or questions or requests for information, if you could let the sponsor know or through committee staff, we'd be happy to make that request as well. So is there anyone else? It doesn't look like there's anyone here in the room to testify for or against the legislation. Is there anyone else on teleconference? Hearing none. Not a lot of testimony either way. But thank you for your presentation of the bill. As is our custom, we will hold it over for a little more consideration and have it back before us in the near future. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is there any further work to come before the committee today? If not, at 20 minutes to 3 in the afternoon, we are adjourned.